Hey everyone, welcome to the Royal Podcast of Oz. It's been a second, but I'm here with fellow podcaster, Mr. Aaron Toman.
Hi. I'm Aaron, and I'm the producer, creator, writer, and director, and pretty much everything else of the Chronicles of Oz.
And you also voice a little-known character.
Yeah, and I played. Yeah, and I played the Scarecrow. Sorry.
Yeah.
That was awkward.
Hey, it's fine. Yeah. It just makes you sound more, you know, relatable.
Sounds like the Scarecrow. Yes.
Okay, so how did you first find that Yellow Brick Road that led you to the wonderful world of Oz?
Well, the first version of Oz I discovered was the old Sinar cartoon from back in the 80s, the one with what's her name, Lois Lane doing the voiceover, the narration. Margot Kidder, that's it, yeah, and all the others. And it was on the TV when I was really little, as a, you know, just before school, it was sort of something you'd watch over your breakfast. And that was really the first exposure I had to Oz, and because I remember watching the MGM movie not long afterwards, saying, hey, that's just like that cartoon I watched, which is, you know, nice and exciting. Yeah, and that's pretty much it. I'm terrible at interviews, sorry.
Oh, you're fine. So how did you wind up finding Baum's books?
They were in the library. So, yeah, I saw the TV show saw the movie and sort of thought, oh, yeah, I like this, got into it and was interested. The books would turn up on the shelf. They were all with the Return to Oz logos and everything else on them, with that era of it. And I started reading them. I thought, and I've always sort of connected it back to that cartoon. It's sort of the world of Oz that's been sort of stuck in my brain, that I read the books and think, oh, yeah, it's just like how they did it in the cartoon, except with other bits and pieces in it. Like suddenly there's a woggle bug and suddenly there's, you know, Ozma's actually in Ozma of Oz, that sort of thing. And so I sort of read some of the books that way, and then, you know, basically the rest is history with that.
Yeah. And somehow you turned into a little bit of a Oz, well, I'm not sure what to say, because in the Chronicles of Oz, there's all these Easter eggs to all sorts of Oz lore, so I'm just like, wow, he really knows his stuff.
Yeah, well, when I was a kid, I sort of stopped being involved with it, sort of, you know, because I was more interested in Mary Poppins and Doctor Who and other sort of things that came along in my world. It wasn't until I got to uni and I was looking for ideas of stuff to create. I'd sort of created some radio plays about Doctor Who and things like that and worked on that. Got to uni, I had this idea that I wanted to sort of, I discovered, I think, that The Wizard of Oz was in the public domain, which meant that I could then, you know, was free to make adaptions of and do whatever I wanted with it. And so I started sort of researching around and sort of thinking, oh, I could do a version of, because I wanted to sort of think, oh, I could adapt these books to make it like that cartoon I used to watch when I was a kid. And so I did some research around it. So I discovered Wicked long before there was a musical about it and read that. What else did I, you know, sort of, I discovered, you know, various websites and sort of read into it and suddenly discovered, oh, there was like a Fairy Log radio plays back in the day, and there was a Broadway version that I suddenly saw, you know, back in 1904, and I really, really wanted to find a version of that to perform it, until I discovered it doesn't really exist. Well, there's no copies of it, and things like that. And so I sort of delved into lots of various versions of Oz, just researching for this version I was writing, and all that sort of just stuck, and then I sort of got into it where I'm suddenly realised I've seen just about all of them now, which is a bit freaky when I think about it.
Except for some of those, you know, foreign language versions.
Well, yeah, I decided I had to draw a line somewhere. Listeners might not know, but I spent most of last year every Saturday night watching a different adaptation of The Wizard of Oz, so or the books or the sequels. So starting with the original silent movies and working all the way through to, I think the last one was Steam Engines of Oz, which I finally got to, which was a bit anticlimactic to end on. And, yeah, and just watched every single one of them in chronological order, just to see how the different ways that people have adapted the old stories. And it was interesting sort of going from, you know, silent movie era where it's all and very sort of free and easy versions of the books, of the story, and then turning it into, moving it into different and, you know, seeing the different stages that they, you know, we went to, sequels to the MGM movie for a fair bit with, you know, Liza Minnelli and Shirley Temple, and then suddenly we've got all these variations where it's what else was it? You know, where we're reimagining Oz, and then suddenly we're doing prequels to Oz, and it's all sort of, it all comes in trends. It's all really interesting.
Yeah, you did Oz Night, and just like, oh, because I remember when I would, like, a few times I would binge wire, watch some of my favorite Oz stuff, and I was like, oh. So, yeah, I was like, oh, just while we're seeing your posts on Facebook and Instagram, I was just like, I know this guy basically just by looking at this.
Well, I was really excited about the idea of seeing some of the more obscure Oz stuff, because, I mean, I've seen the MGM movie a gazillion times. I've seen the Sinar cartoon a million times now, because I've discovered it's now on Blu-ray, so now I've got that. And, you know, things like... Yeah, Emerald City and, you know, Oz the Great and Powerful. Those ones, Return to Oz, the ones that everyone's seen. But there's all these other strange versions that I hadn't really come across before. Or, like, you'd read about, and you'd see a book somewhere, there'd be an obscure reference to, like, my favourite, like, you'd see things like the Strawberry Shortcake and the VeggieTales version ones, which were a bit sort of, oh, it's, you know, an episode of another series. It's just, oh, we're doing an Oz episode, which sort of felt a bit cheesy. But there was one I liked where, I think it's, Oz Rock and Roll Musical. It's an Australian version, which, you know, I can relate to for obvious reasons. But the weird thing is, a lot of it was, like, I live in Melbourne, and a lot of the settings were, it was made in the 70s and set in Melbourne. So a lot of this, and the, instead of their representation of the Emerald City was Melbourne. It's like how the Wiz had New York City, we had Melbourne. So suddenly when they're going to, you know, the Palace of the Wizard, which is the Palais Theatre, which is literally down the road from me, I was like, oh, I know that one. I go have lunch there. It had a weird sort of, you know, Dorothy's catching a tram down the Yellow Brick Road, essentially. It sort of felt a bit too real. That was the one I found most interesting. But there was other sort of very obscure versions of Oz that you think, well, oh, that's sort of... Yeah, there was, I want to say, Fantastic Something of Oz, one of the Russian adaptation of the Russian book.
That was one of the recent ones with...
Earth and Juice, where they did this. It wasn't of the first book, which was annoying because I want to see an adaptation of that, but where they sort of take the Russian version of The Marvelous Land of Oz and do the adaptation of that, and comparing that to... You know, things like the Shirley Temple Marvelous Land of Oz, and how a more direct adaptation, where this is an adaptation of an adaptation. It was fascinating just to see the different stories going into different sort of, you know, avenues and different things. And then, of course, I'm doing my own writing. You know, I was writing season 3 of the Chronicles of Oz at the time, so suddenly it's like, ooh, I'm going to write... Suddenly I'd watch an episode, and then I'd be writing the episode, and then write an episode, ooh, I'm going to work a reference to that in there, and so suddenly have things like, you know, singing songs from the Tale of the Wizard of Oz, or big giant eggs suddenly growing and becoming big giant major, you know, growing and smashing everything in place, which is a reference to the 1936, like 30-something, the little cartoon.
Estimated to be about 33.
So I never know the dates. I just know, oh, was it before? It was before MGM, but just sort of right on the cusp of that, and before. You know, the last version of Oz before Judy Garland took over everything.
Yeah, I did this thing where I ran a site and I basically listed all the different versions of Oz I'd seen, so I put them all in chronological order, and doing stuff like that, I'm like, oh yeah, it's this year and that year, and I'm just like, boy.
I recommend if anyone hasn't done it and anyone's got the time to do it, it's worth just watching them and just see the progression of how the different ways that we retell the same basic... Because it's a fairly straightforward story, but the variation on it is brilliant. You've got, whether it's the prequel like Wicked or Oz the Great and Powerful, or where we're telling, oh, we have to tell the backstory. You've got ones like, you know, Tin Man, where it's basically we're telling the story, but we're going to twist it all on its head and do a completely, you know, inverted version of it. You know, Emerald City's a bit like that. You've got, you know, ones that are very clearly... the MGM movie, but taken, you know, try and do a sequel on it. So you've got a gazillion versions suddenly of a glut of the Land of Oz, which is all, you know, Ethel Merman's in there. You've got Liza Minnelli. You've got, you know, the Shirley Temple one, the lovely, wonderful Land of Oz, which is so fun when you've had too much wine, just want to sit there and laugh at it because it's so, so... Everyone should just watch that one just for the fun of it. And then there's a real off-the-wall ones, like the Australian one, which is retelling the story, but through a very grungy, you know, 70s sort of backdrop. You've got the, Oh, the Wizard of Oz. It was just before the last of the silent movies, where the you know, the guy that played the Scarecrow wrote and directed it as well, which is totally out there. I can't believe anyone would do that. that, yeah, that one, which takes the germ of the Wizard of Oz and does its entirely different thing, which is off the wall crazy, but it's different. It's like, this isn't Oz as anyone remembers it, but it's enough to think, hang on, this is, but you can see where they're riffing off the material.
Yeah. So it, yeah, you're right. It has been in the quiet progression through there. Although, yeah. I do have to say one thing. If you're doing that, do not do a bunch of anime versions all at once.
Oh, yeah.
Because I did that in preparation for an episode of the podcast, and by the time I was done, I was like, can we please just do another story already?
There was a glutton around the 80s where it was like, you know, you hit the 80s point, there's all anime versions of it. They're all slightly low quality. You know, the animation isn't great. They're all a bit funny. Although, oh, that's the other one, the Wonderful Galaxy of Oz. I think that one, well, again, I found that really, that's one of the ones where I watched it and I thought, hang on, this is, you watch it and think, oh, I wish I'd had that idea, because, I mean, they set it into the future, so it's basically, it's Farscape but a cartoon, and it's all futuristic and spaceships and everything like that, with, you know, still the Wizard of Oz, so she falls through a, is it a wormhole? She's in a spaceship rather than a house and, you know, thing, but they make the reveal about the wizard happen halfway through the story, which I thought was, rather than toward the end, it's like in the middle, she meets the wizard, and suddenly the wizard is, spoilers, the wizard's revealed as a fraud, as a humbug, but they do that halfway through, and then they have to go deal with the Wicked Witch, which I thought was an interesting way to sort of do it, because suddenly the stakes are high, they don't have this wizard in the background to sort of help them out, they actually have to do it all on their own. It's, you know, it's things like that that sort of get me excited. Think, oh, that's a different way to tell the story. I wish I'd done that. Or why didn't I do that? Or, you know, and, you know, file it away and try and think of it as you try and find a way to work into a story later on.
Yeah. That's kind of my, what I thought I might do for one. So, yeah. Let's see. So when you're not doing Oz, you at least used to act a lot, right?
Yeah, so I've done a lot of theatre more than anything else is my sort of my background. Nothing professional, unfortunately, I wish. But a lot of amateur theatre doing, you know, musicals and plays. Did a performance of The Wizard of Oz about 10 years ago with a theatre company back where I was born, back in Gippsland. I didn't get to play the Scarecrow audition, but I got to play Crow Number One, which meant I got to be his backup dancer, which was fun for the Scarecrow, I'm sure. But yeah, done a lot of theatre, a lot of one-act plays. So they're plays that are sort of between 20 and 40 minutes long, where I wrote, directed, and we took them to festivals to enter into competitions. So won a few awards on that, which was pretty fun. That was sort of my main, that's been the bulk of my, you know, theatrical experience. I've done the acting, I've done the writing, I've done the directing. Lately, Oz has taken over a fair bit because it tends to be fairly involved trying to get it all done and get it underway, so I haven't done as much theatre as I'd like, but it's fun to do. It's something to do, when the day job isn't happening.
Yeah, so you have a pretty good feel for what works dramatically and all.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You've done The Chronicles of Oz, and you recently completed season 3. It's all out there for everyone to listen to.
So, ChroniclesOz.com.
6 episodes per season, each season adapting one Oz book. And how would you describe your approach to Chronicles of Oz?
Well, if I want to be really basic about it, my original approach was that I originally did a version of it. Version of the Chronicles of Oz back in 2001 when I first started uni, and my idea was basically I wanted to recreate the Sinar series because it wasn't freely available at the time. I'd seen it, but hadn't seen it in a long while, and I sort of wanted to couldn't get it, but I sort of wanted to make how I remembered it. And so originally it was like, oh, this is going to be a fairly straightforward adaptation of the book, but with my own sort of spin on it and things like that. That version got recorded and never finished because various other life stuff happened and never got done. We did the first 2 seasons, just never sort of got through it. But then when I probably about 5 or 6 years ago, I thought, oh, I'm going to pick this up and try it again and sort of do that. And I'd sort of, I changed my approach because by then I discovered The West Wing, Aaron Sorkin's The West Wing, and I'd sort of got a bit in love with the idea of, you know, a story about the corridors of power and, you know, a political drama, but using the Land of Oz as a backdrop, which is sort of the starting point for the Chronicles of Oz came in, because I was fascinated by the idea, and it's sort of how I remember the Sinar cartoon going when I was a kid, but it never actually went that way. But it's sort of, you know, you've got this land which is all perfectly balanced. It's not great, nothing's perfect, but you've got this wizard in the middle holding all these four witches at bay who are ruling the four quadrants of Oz. And this one person turns up, takes one out, and then suddenly the entire political structure changes in about a week. And, you know, purely because this one person wanders through the Land of Oz, and wanders through this place just trying to get home. And, you know, the second book comes along and suddenly she's basically installed this new, new monarch, who then is immediately toppled over, and then Ozma comes back and all is the lost princess and all that sort of thing. So it suddenly became, it's a story about, you could tell a story about how, you know, about power and about how, make it a proper political drama, but with the fantasy element. So it ended up being a bit sort of Game of Thrones, but not quite so gritty. And so I always describe it as the West Wing in Oz. Wizard of Oz told like the West Wing, but which is, it's sort of like that, but it's gone off in its own direction as well.
One thing I absolutely loved about it was how you expanded the roles of the Guardian of the Gates, the Soldier with Green Whiskers, and Jelly and Jam.
Mm-hmm. That was me trying to work, because I also, one of the problems I found rewriting the Wizard of Oz is that it doesn't really, well, I say, oh yeah, I want to do the West Wing, but in Oz. But I realised this plot of the Wizard of Oz doesn't really align to the West Wing, because the West Wing is all about, oh, they're in the White House and they're writing, you know, trying to deal with policy and, you know, managing people. But the focus of the Wizard of Oz is on these people who are nowhere near the Emerald City. They're not there. That's the point. They're outside the circle. So I need to sort of get an inside voice to the to the runnings of, you know, the Oz equivalent of the White House. And, you know, so you've got your Leo McGarry, who was on the Andy. You've got Jellia Jam, or Jellia Jam, as we decided to call her, because, you know, I couldn't deal with the pun. But we got her as CJ Craig. Is sort of, you've got that sort of dynamic going on. And it was Daniel Burnett, the guy who does our sound recording and does all that. When he read a first draft of the Chronicles of Oz, the first season, he realized, he gave me the note that we need to see more of that material. Because originally, in the original version I wrote, Jellia Jam and Omby Amby and Faramant don't turn up until pretty much we don't see them until we get to the Emerald City and Dorothy gets there and they're arrested. And that's the first appearance of them. And he gave me the best note about things like that. In Game of Thrones, you've got all these different pockets of people dealing with the same sort of issues all at the same time, and you cut between the two of them. Whereas I had a fairly linear, okay, we start with Dorothy, we follow Dorothy through her journey all the way through, where Dorothy's in basically every single scene. He said the best thing he could have said is where, you know, cut away from Dorothy a bit and show this major event happening to various people outside, you know, in other parts of Oz. So we cut, and see how it's affecting everybody across the country. And so suddenly I got a lot more mileage out of these three characters in the running the Emerald City, dealing with how their reaction to suddenly, you know, this major power in that's not too far away from the city is suddenly being taken out. The city has to go into lockdown, all this major panic going on in the Emerald City, to contrast that with the fairly familiar story of, you know, these four people traveling down the Yellow Brick Road. And that's where, you know, this trio of weird sort of, you know, civil servants basically sort of came about, where suddenly as well we've got these three, you know, characters trying to make sense of what's going on around them.
I also noticed that, you know, this is one of the Easter eggs, is that is when, for, you know, the Guardian of the Gates, you named him Faramant from Alexander Volkov's Magic Land series. You know, people who listen to the podcast should know, but just in case they're tuning in for the first time, that was like, he adapted the Wizard of Oz for Russian readers and then did his own series of sequels that sometimes played off the original old stories, but were mostly just original stories themselves. So I thought that was...
Yeah, and that's part of the thing. I'm terrible at making up names. That's part of my thing where it's like, I have to make a character, or what am I going to call them? And so part of it's also Easter eggs. Part of me's also going, okay, well, if I don't have to make up a name, is there a character already in Oz or in the Oz canon, which, or the Oz mythos, which is, you know, huge at this point? Is there a name I can borrow to sort of use that and sort of give it that extra balance? So when I approached these characters, I knew we had Jellia Jam and we had Ombi Ambi as a sort of key roles, but I thought I need the third one to balance it out. I thought, well, I'll split the Guardian of the Gates role into two roles. So we had Ombi Ambi. I thought I have to give another name. And for about 5 minutes, the other character is called Want to Win Battles, but I didn't want to do I knew that would sound awkward on an audio play, so I thought, oh, I need to find another name. So I went to the Volkov books, you know, at least the Wikipedia article based on the books, because I haven't actually read them because I don't read Russian. But I went through that and found they've got and found the names and thought, okay, that makes a good name. Faramount was Ombi Ambi's equivalent in that book, so I'm using them both. And it kind of really works. You know, it's same sort of things like the witch needed an assistant at some point. So I thought, okay, well, what are the names of some prominent Winkies? Because I need a Winky name. And then I found, oh, hang on, in book, whichever number it is, 12, I want to say, The Lost Princes of Oz, the villain is a Winky and he's called Ugu, the shoemaker. So I thought, oh, hang on, I could put this character in, give the witch an offsider and call him Ugu, and everyone would say, oh, it's a reference to the future, which it actually is. I've got a plan for what's going to happen with that character. But, you know, it gives it an extra sort of, you know, like you said, it's an Easter egg for people who know the books and know the story. Think, oh, hang on, I know that name. But it's also, anyone who doesn't know what's going on, well, it's just the name of a random sounding character.
And you also had, and honestly, I want to say thank you for that, because I've seen people come up with names for Oz characters that sound like complete gibberish. I'm like, oh, goodness gracious.
Oh, the millions of names I have for the Wicked Witch of the West, which I'm not immune to. When I wrote the very, very first adaptation of it back in 2001, and I had the witch scenes coming up, I just read the Book of Wicked. Like I said, this is before the musical was a thing. It hadn't been written. The musical hadn't happened. It was just a book based on the Wicked Witch, which influenced my writing at the time, my approach to Oz as well, because it sort of jived so much with what I wanted to do with the book, with the series. But I originally called the witch Effie, because I thought, oh, I'll name it after this. I'll use the name. No one's going to know the name Elphaba. That's not going to be a thing. No one's going to see that as a reference, which when I approached this new draft, I was like, yeah, that's going. The witch is not going to have a name. I'm going to make a thing. The witch doesn't have a name, because there's so many versions of them, and none of them quite work. They're sort of like, they don't sound like what you would imagine. They don't sort of fit with the character, if that makes sense. It's like, maybe because there's just so many of them. Like, there's Azcadelia, there's Eveline, Evermine. Who are the other ones? I'm trying to think of the various versions.
See, there's Aladap, Mordred, I think, was one of them. And
yeah, I've seen versions where they call her Mombi, just because I think Baum did that in one of the versions, rather than actually have the Wicked Witch called her Mombi.
That was the 1910 one, I don't think he wrote that one, but
they blurred together eventually. But yeah, Mistress West. There's all these various what was one in Once Upon a Time? I can't remember now. Zelina, that's it.
Right.
And they're all they sound like they're all variations of the word Oz, or like Elphaba's the one that sort of sticks out the most, but it's L. Frank Baum. It's all very sort of, they're interesting, but they don't really jive with me as a name for the character. So I like it better when the Wicked Witch just doesn't have a name. It just sort of works. Couldn't do that with the Good Witch of the North. There was a version of that where she was called Taddy Poo, and I thought, but I don't quite like that name. And a lot of the name picking I do is sort of which one sounds better to me. Which one sounds better when it's being read out, you know, in a studio, which sounds better coming out of a speaker when someone says it. So, you know, you've got names like Taddy Poo or Acosta. Well, Acosta sounds more, it sounds more magical and more authoritative, whereas Taddy Poo sounds like she's it sounds slightly rude and a bit childish. And that's where I'm sort of going, you know, trying to get that balance of, you know, who the character's called and what they do.
Yeah, I have my own idea of why the Wicked Witch doesn't have a name, but I won't say it right now. It's a bit going off topic.
I'm going to spoil Chronicles of Oz Season 3 here, so bear with me. So if you haven't heard Season 3, everyone go listen to that.
But okay, yes. Yeah. This is the spoiler wall. If you haven't heard the season yet, it's available for free. Go to chroniclesofoz.com We're in your podcast app for Crossover Adventure Productions, and download the episode to listen, and you can come back here and listen to the rest of this.
Yeah. But I
warned you.
Yes, warning, 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 spoilers. But, so there's a sequence in the third season where Dorothy and the witch have a talk about about names and how appropriating using a name, you know, gives people power and gives people authority. And the witch makes a point that Dorothy doesn't know the Wicked Witch's name. She's never actually asked it. She knows everybody else. Even the Gnome King has a name, is given a name. But the Wicked Witch hasn't got one. She sort of points that out, goes, "What's my name, Dorothy?" And that whole sequence came out of the fact that I had originally given the witch a name but then decided I didn't want to. And I thought, well, this could be a thing where you don't really have, you know, Dorothy and, sorry, making sure I'm still recording, where, yeah, this feeling that Dorothy and, I've lost the train of my thought there. I had this idea that, you know, when I was writing season one, I realized, okay, I'm not going to give this character a name, this key character. I knew back then the character's going to come back and sort of have this thing. So I had in mind that I was going to come back to it and sort of make it a thing. Okay, why doesn't this character have a name? It relates to the fact that Dorothy isn't giving her a name, or isn't caring enough to ask about a name. She's going to turn up and kill this person who's just basically a wicked witch. That's all she is, which, you know, plays into the more mature themes I want to take from the source material and take it into a new sort of unfamiliar realm that people wouldn't necessarily expect when they see The Wizard of Oz.
So you just finished season 3, Ozma of Oz, and I think it's one of the best adaptations of the story I've experienced.
Oh, that's too kind, really.
Ozma became front and center, whereas most adaptations fall off of Obama's book and keep Dorothy as the main focus of the story.
Well, yeah, it never made sense to me when I was reading the book. I thought it's called Ozma of Oz, and Ozma doesn't turn up till halfway through. And when she does, she's there, but she doesn't really contribute. It's all Dorothy's story. It may as well be, you know, it's Dorothy, it's her story, it's her adventure. Ozma's one of the first ones that gets turned to a ornament hat when they turn up the Gnome King's thing. It's all focused directly on Dorothy. So my idea was, well, we've already had a story based focus on Dorothy. What I wanted to tell is a story sort of about Dorothy as well, but Dorothy from the outside. What is she like from someone else's perspective? Because we've all had her perspective at this point. We want to see what she's like elsewhere. And given this is about this is called Ozma of Oz, it leans itself into trying to, you know, justify that title, which is sort of what I did the same thing with season 2 as well. I tried to say, oh, it's called the Marvelous Land of Oz. Why is it called the Marvelous Land of Oz? So there's lots of references into making Oz marvelous. We want Oz to be better than it was. Then that's why people are trying to take over Oz and do all that. It's all about justifying the reason that Baum gave these really, really stupid titles to these books. So, and yeah, Ozma of Oz was an easy one. I wanted to put Ozma front and center, make it all about her, make it about, you know, her struggles, you know, where is she going to come from, given the backstory in this version of Ozma. You know, she's been thrown into this world where, you know, where she's all these expectations that she's a lost princess of Oz is going to come back and save Oz in its time of greatest need, which she's already done, essentially. And now she's there. She's just has to get on with being the ruler of Oz. And all she's hearing about is how wonderful, how great the first season was, how great Dorothy was in the first season, doing everything like that. And all she's doing is being queen. And it's like, is it, you know, is that enough? Is she actually going to justify her existence? And yeah, and then the best part of that is then you put Dorothy back in the storyline and suddenly, oh, we've got Ozma and Dorothy trying to battle against each other. They're trying to sort of deal with the, you know, suddenly Ozma's coming face to face with this person that she's basically living her life in reference to. And meanwhile, Dorothy's come along, she's got her own issues going on, but it puts them into direct conflict, which makes for a more interesting story than, oh, they turned up and they were instantly friends, which is nice and, you know, it's cheery and it makes for happier stories, but it's not more interesting stories.
I remember I first heard about the Chronicles of Oz and you posted a link on the Regalia, which is now defunct, email list, and I decided to check it out thinking, oh, I hope this isn't just another one of those so-called radio plays. It's really just a bunch of kids reading the book.
There's a few of those, yeah.
So I downloaded all the episodes of season one. I started listening, I'm like, oh, yeah, it's a modern-day version. Dorothy's much older. And then I get to Munchkin Land, and then I hear an arrow whiz, and oh.
uh, Fun fact, the first Munchkin that's killed is voiced by Wendy Robinson, who plays Glinda. She was in there on the day recording one of the scenes for Glinda. She does, usually lives out of town and records on her own, but she came in that day just because she wanted to be part of the deal. So she recorded the scene with the Wicked Witch that she has in episode 4. But she happened to be, and she was there for the Wicked Witch's death scene, which was spectacular. We all applauded. Really so good. And then after that, we went and recorded some backing stuff for the extra Munchkins that they got killed, you know, they get killed in that opening attack and start of the Munchkin Civil War, which just makes me laugh every time I say it, Munchkin Civil War. But, so yeah, in that opening scene, we just had whoever was available thing. So we've got Tom Denham, who normally plays the Lion, Elise D'Amico, who plays the Witch, and Wendy Robinson playing, who plays Glinda, are all in the same room just playing these random Munchkins, putting on voices. So if you listen, you can tell us then. But yeah, Wendy was so excited because after seeing Elise's death sequence and getting in, she gets to record her own death sequence, and she was, oh my god, I get to have a death scene, oh my god, that's so good. It was, you know, a lovely moment to hear, oh yeah, she's the first death in Oz, she's the first Munchkin to get killed in the Civil War, which is a bit, you know, nice and fun for her.
Well, that's a fascinating piece of behind the scenes information. Another character I think you improved on was the Wogglebug, because Bomlet said that up until that point in the book, which was like over halfway through, that Jack Pumpkin had mainly been the star, so he decided to introduce a new character. But then he comes in and he's not very essential to the plot. He comes in and makes these puns and some observations, but it's nothing you really couldn't give to another character. But you found a more interesting way to use him, I think.
Yeah, the Wogglebug was a weird... John Jennings plays him brilliantly, came in, did a lot of this stuff on his own because it wasn't available for the bulk of the recording session, so he had to do it all independent on a, you know, in a separate recording thing, and sort of just nailed it, pretty much 1-2 takes done, doing exactly the right performance that I needed, and it was, oh, I can't wait to bring him back. I'm annoyed I couldn't fit him into season 3, but I had everyone else in season 3. But, yeah, because the Wogglebug is a character in the Land of Oz that you would cut out, that, and most people do. It's very rare you see an adaptation where the Wogglebug comes in. He's a character that in the book doesn't turn up until well over halfway through. Most of the core group is already turned up, and suddenly there's this random character making puns all the way through, which are, you know, they're not bad puns. Some of them are better than others. Most of them are just stupid. But there's sort of, you know, but, you know, he's a sort of comedy character that doesn't quite justify the notoriety that came afterwards at the time where they had all this merchandise and, you know, these, you know, the stage play. Like, who would you name the stage play of the Land of Oz after the Wogglebug? It's, of all the characters, you'd go to Pumpkinhead before you go to the Wogglebug. It seems really odd that he got this focus. So I wanted to make sure the Wogglebug was included in there somewhere, and just sort of thought, well, he can provide that commentary to what's going on. He sort of, and that sort of came in later in the story. I made sure he was included earlier in the season. I wanted him there. And then I gave him a history to the invading Munchkins, so they could sort of, so he knew more or less what they were. So you know, he could give sort of those impending warnings and be around, but sort of be someone who knows what's going on and explain to everybody else why this is important, what's happening, what's the context around this potentially complex idea of the Munchkins are suddenly rising up. They've been fighting with each other, and now they're going to fight with the Emerald City, and why they're replacing, you know, the Army of Revolt in the first book. And I mean, I don't think I dealt with the Wogglebug too spectacularly towards the end of the season. He sort of disappears off once the plot focuses more directly on Tip being Ozma and the whole mystery around that. It sort of drills in there. He disappears until the end, but which is annoying because I love hearing John play the role. I was like, oh, he's just so, you know, deliciously pompous. So I've told him to play it very much like the people in Yes Minister. Sort of very old-fashioned, sort of very, you know, uptight and crazy, but, you know, a bit sort of frantic and that, but sort of so full of himself, it's brilliant, basically.
And, yeah, there was also the big change in Marvelous Land, where instead of an all-female Army of Revolt, it's now General Ginger leading the Munchkins. So that was a bit of a switch-up. Which,
yeah,
I kind of think that was for the better.
Yeah, it's one of those things, where, again, I've taken a very fast and loose attitude to the books, and that was, it was deliberate as well, because I thought there's, are many versions of Oz out there that take the books and replicate them. Exactly. I know the Colonial Radio Theatre do a very strict adaptation of the books. You've got audiobooks on YouTube of people reading it all over the place where, you know, they're the books themselves. And usually when someone does a version of this, they're very things. So I took a lot of the ideas, okay, I approached every idea and thought, okay, well, what is the realistic application of this event happening? If the capital city of this country gets invaded by a neighboring, by someone else, by an uprising force, well, why would they do that? What is it? It has to be more than, oh, we want to steal the emeralds, we're going to be an all-female army stabbing people with our knitting needles. It just seemed so really, well, sexist is obvious, but it just seems so twee and so, oh, isn't this funny? Oh, we're making comment and, you know, what's the worst thing they do? Well, they make the men go in the kitchen, do all the cooking while they go and sit around doing nothing all day. Actually, I'm not sure if that was in the book or in the cartoon now I think about it. They all blend together eventually. But the motivations didn't quite sit with me. So I thought, no, it has to be something more realistic. And if it's more realistic, an army in revolt, would not be just women. It couldn't be. It wouldn't logically be. It could be run by women, you know, and have them higher up in the echelons. But that's why I made sure that it was more... I spun it into, okay, it's the Munchkins doing something else and made it more realistic. It comes down to Ginger's motivation is basically that her father was the old ruler of this, you know, general of this army, and is executed as, you know, part of the, Oz equivalent of the Nuremberg trials, where suddenly, well, they take him and they execute him to try and stop the fighting, and so she takes it as a personal affront. Okay, so now it's all about her avenging her father's death, and becomes more of a visceral thing rather than, oh, we want to steal the emeralds, or, oh, we don't like the Scarecrow being in charge, which isn't enough. It wouldn't be enough for someone to go and then suddenly to take over a city and push that, you know, have that motivation, if that makes sense.
Yeah, when Mom was doing it, there was a lot of people trying to make fun of the feminist movement, and he does this thing where he does have this army of women doing it for pretty frivolous reasons, but then at the end of the story, he introduces a female ruler who actually is the rightful ruler and ultimately becomes a good ruler.
Oh yeah, and look, don't get me wrong, the books are a thing of its time. It's, you know, it's dealing with, you know, the suffrage movement and all that sort of thing, women's rights, early versions of women's rights, when that was all coming into, you know, coming into vogue and all that sort of thing happening. And so it spins on that. So you've got these women, you know, different female protagonists, you know, trying to vie for power, and it ends up being, you know, a matriarchal system replacing a very patriarchal system, which is really interesting and stuff from when you're looking at, you know, oh yeah, it's 1904, 1905, so therefore it's appropriate then, but suddenly to have an all female army would feel, at best, patronizing. And I thought, it's not the story I wanted to tell. I wanted to tell something a bit more focused on, you know, well, the story of that one is more about the dual thing of Tip and the Scarecrow having their different sort of, you know, coming to terms with their own struggles and their adventures, and just having this sort of what is essentially a comic army coming in wouldn't really vibe with that. There is a version I wrote back, because I wrote back in 2001, 2002, I wrote the very first, I wrote versions of the first two books. And there is a version I've got of the Marvelous Land of Oz, which has an all-female army in it, and it doesn't quite work because Ginger's much more frivolous and much more, you know, Legally Blonde, Del Woods, perky, oh my god, Oliver, and sort of being real ditzy, and it doesn't, there's no threat to her because she's not really just, she's no, you know, you couldn't believe this woman could run a bake sale, let alone run a country. There's no, or command an army. It doesn't quite happen, at least in the version I end up writing. Mombi ends up becoming the greater threat. But so in this version, I want to avoid that. I want to make sure Ginger was as powerful as, you know, as scary as anybody else. Mombi, and, you know, and therefore when she clashes with Mombi, it becomes more of a thing. And I think that's what it comes down to, is I want a version that was more interesting to me. That's my goal of any decision I make when I change something from the books, is, okay, what's the more interesting version of this? That's sort of going back to the Munchkin Civil War and the, you know, arrows flying thing. I wanted, where that came about was I wanted to do a version of Oz where I was writing the you know, the first episode of Oz. And you had Dorothy crash in the house and she meets the Munchkins and Glinda turns up and she says, oh, you must follow the yellow brick road and go see the Wizard of Oz. And here, take these silver slippers, which belong to the Wicked Witch of the East. And all by the numbers, exactly how the Wizard of Oz is told in every single storybook version we've ever read and ever seen. And it just thought, I got bored. I thought, I know this story backwards. Anyone who's going to listen to this knows how this story plays out. They know where it goes. What's a more interesting way to do this? And so then I hit upon the idea, well, Dorothy doesn't need to walk from the Emerald City. She needs to run because it's too dangerous for her to be in the Wizard of Oz and into be in Munchkinland. And there's a bit in the book of the Wicked Book where Glinda and Elphaba are talking, and Glinda talks about how she had to get the shoes, gave Dorothy the silver slippers because she needed to get them out of Munchkinland because it would cause too much issue if the silver slippers stayed there because there'll be factions of power fighting over these icons. And that's sort of all, that's where it all came in. So, okay, well, when Dorothy gets there, they're not going to be singing and dancing. They're not going to be excited about, they're not going to be, oh, yay, the Wicked Witch is dead, woo, and, you know, have the high-pitched, you know, squeaky voices and all the stereotypical stuff. It's going to be, they're going to be normal voices, normal people, and reacting exactly the same way as if you were in the middle of a city and suddenly, there was after a storm, suddenly, the leader of the country got squashed by a person and, you know, and that person was a divisive ruler. Someone, you know, they have their supporters and their detractors, you know, their opponents. How would that react? And, you know, and it's a much more exciting way to start a story, saying, oh, okay, Dorothy has to run through Oz because she's now in, she lands there and she's immediately in danger, rather than, oh, I'm just going to skip down the road and eventually she'll come across a scarecrow. It needed more oomph for that to get the story moving.
Yeah. And even had wound up offing one of the characters is there with Bok.
Poor Bok. That's the thing. One of the other things I'd seen in most of these adaptations of The Wizard of Oz, every one of them has variations of the magic shoes. Every one of them has Dorothy making references to lions and tigers and bears and No Place Like Home. And almost every single one of them has Bok for some unknown reason. Once Upon a Time has Bok turn up out of nowhere. And they're all variations of it. So I want to work Bok into this story. Because it's a non-character in the book. He just turns up, he welcomes her, yay, have some food, and then sends her on away again in very early chapter. It's written off character, but he just seems to turn up. And so I wanted to put Bok in there, and I wanted to sort of give everyone the idea that anything could happen in these Oz stories. So not only have I, like, it starts off predictably, Dorothy lands in Oz, she's got her uncle and aunt and all that sort of thing. Then suddenly the Civil War happens, and suddenly she's being given a orders, go, you know, give the instruction, go follow the yellow brick road, and Bok says, I'll go with you. And I thought, okay, I'm going to convince people that maybe this version of Oz is not going to have a scarecrow, it's going to have Bok instead, because that's the sort of thing you would expect from this version of Oz, this sort of retelling, because that's what other versions have done. And then kill him. So suddenly everyone's a bit, well, what's going to, you know, we've got this main character and suddenly he's been killed. Where does this leave? You know, keep everybody a bit on their toes. You know, anything can happen. Anyone can die in this story. Then, of course, the real Scarecrow turns up and he's pretty much as expected when you get the Scarecrow and the Wizard of Oz. It's, you know, he's silly, he's crazy, he's one step away from being Ray Bolger. It's that sort of thing. And that sort of reassures everyone, okay, we are still doing Oz as we remember it. It's still not going to be that far away from the original books and the original stories and ones everyone knows. But it gives you that thing, okay, well, something could still, you know, we're not necessarily going to be saying the same story that everyone knows too well at this point.
Right. Okay, now you're 3 seasons in. You're getting ready for season 4.
Mm-hmm.
All right. You mentioned that an influence on how you were writing the episodes was the BBC's adaptation of The Chronicles of Narnia for television.
Yes. Well, that's sort of a influenced the format of it. 6 episodes. Like, so yeah, there was a, for those that don't know, there was back in the '90s. There was a TV series version of The Chronicles of Narnia the BBC did. They didn't quite do the same thing we did, but I've sort of that's the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, and they covered it in 6 episodes. They split the story up, and it's a fairly straightforward adaptation. It's, you know, takes the book and reworks it. And that was my first sort of way into sort of when I first started writing this version of it. That's sort of how I approached it. Okay, I'm going to take the story, put it into 6 episodes, and then do the same thing for each book going forward. Weirdly, it was I was rewatching the other day the Disney movie remakes they did about 10 years ago of the Chronicles of Narnia. They did the first 3 books, And that also had a big influence on how I approached Oz, because you look at how they do Narnia. They take the book, but then they give it that veneer of reality. Like, how would this happen in reality? So you start, like, the C.S. Lewis's book says, okay, the four children were in the Second World War, and they, you know, and they had to be evacuated. So the movie shows you them in the Second World War, and they suddenly make it real and make it visceral. Then they take that imagery and transfer it into the battle that happens in Narnia, and say, okay, they're going to make it look like the Second World War, but with flying griffins and, you know, minotaurs and, you know, unicorns and, you know, centaurs and all those other things that happen in the movie and things like that. And just sort of the different reactions that people... There was a lot of the way they approached those movies that sort of wound its way into Oz. Things like... What's another one that happened? In... Don't know anyone's seen The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, the third movie, where in the book there's a sequence where Lucy is about... She's reading her she's reading spell books, and she imagines being beautiful like Susan, and sort of, you know, and fantasizes that. And it's a sort of a very throwaway moment in the book, and I think in the TV series they did the same thing. They referred to it, they referenced it, and then they just moved on because it wasn't something that got dwelt on. But they turned that into a plot point around Lucy, and that's her motivation. She wishes she was like her bigger sister, and it motivates her through the characters. So she's still doing the same thing, but she's got this underlying drive that influences why she's doing all these different stuff. And that's the sort of thing I wanted to try and work into Oz. So Dorothy, Ozma's probably a better example of that one. She's a more recent one where, you know, Ozma's still travelling to the land of Ev to help out the Princess Langwidere and to rescue the Ev royal family and goes to the Gnome King and does all that. But it's not coming from a place of, oh, I'm just a happy princess doing things because I'm just such a good princess and I'm a good person. She's actually got a deeper drive. She's got different, deeper needs that she needs to prove herself. She doesn't feel secure in what she's doing, and she wants to make herself more authoritative and that sort of thing. That's where the Narnia thing, sort of the way they approached it, sort of made me want to sort of do the same sort of thing to Oz. Take that original story and deepen it, give it more motivation.
Has there been any other things you've enjoyed that have kind of influenced your take on Oz?
Oh, so many things. I'm a major Doctor Who fan, so there's a lot of Doctor Who storytelling ideas in this series. Another big influence for anyone that knows Big Finish Productions and their radio play series. I mean, a lot of these are done in the style of Big Finish as well. That's part of where that comes from. But they did a series called Gallifrey, a radio series, which is the best thing they've done. It's based on where the Doctor Who comes from, and he's, the president and of the Council of Time Lords and the political machinations going on there. That's another huge influence of how I've approached Oz. It was all about political infighting and people trying to vie for power and all that sort of thing. So that was one of the, you know, I heard that series and thought, oh, I want to do the, you know, it's again, it sort of fed into because I saw that, then I saw the West Wing, and then suddenly it's like, oh, this is how I want to tell the story of Oz. I'm trying to think of any other influences. That's probably the main thing. Once Upon a Time is a big one as well, where they sort of, you know, take the fantastical and then try and ground it a little bit and say, how was it sort of, you know, how do you make this, weird, crazy stuff or put it into a realistic setting? Everything is all sort of filtered through. Okay, how would this really happen? To a point. I mean, there is a limit of, like, you know, certain things have to be pushed in a certain direction because that's how it works. But, you know, like, I find it difficult to believe that someone like the wizard would be able to sort of confuse an entire country that he's all great and powerful without someone demanding proof that quick, sometime sooner, and it wouldn't come unraveled that quickly the way I handled it. But I'm trying to think. Musicals are sort of a general thing that I'm sort of into as well, so a lot of the stuff is sort of trying to sort of give it a bit of an operatic sort of tone is probably another way I'm sort of going into that. I don't know, I can't think of any other influences off the top of my head. Give me an hour and I'll suddenly think, oh, and I remember this and I remember that, and I'll be able to list a whole bunch of other ones, I'm sure.
Okay. Alright, so, yeah, well. Alright, so, are there any teasers you can drop for Season 4, or should we just really wait and see?
So Season 4 I haven't quite written yet. I'm sort of still planning on it. I've got a whiteboard with all these ideas on the screen, written up with all these sort of thoughts, and I actually have to sit down and plot it. So we're doing the next season's Dorothy and the Wizard in Oz. People seem to think we're skipping that and going straight to Emerald City of Oz, but no, we're going to do all the books. We're going to continue sort of following the story. So the Wizard comes back, which everyone is very excited about, it seems, that I'm hearing about everyone. So I was like, oh, I want to see how Dorothy and the Wizard meet up with each other. And I'm kind of keen to see how that plays out too, because I'm not quite sure how I'm going to make it work. The interesting thing is, in the books, Dorothy and the Wizard parted relatively friendly, and the Wizard's toned down very, very much. So he was able to walk back into the series and just be, oh, I'm the Wizard and I'm back, and, you know, everything's all fine and dandy. But in my version, Dorothy and the Wizard did not part very well. And then since the Wizard left, we've learned he's actually did some rather horrible things to King Pastoria and the baby Ozma, and was responsible for all that happening. And sort of, you know, it's... And now I'm going to sort of bring you back. And the Wizard, the idea is he's going to be back as a fairly regular character. He's sort of... That's how it works in the books, and I want the Wizard to be back in Oz. So that's going to be the goal. So the trick is going to be how we're going to rehabilitate this character who is actually rather not very nice from what it seems. And it's not going to be easy because Dorothy has to get over it, because Dorothy has to forgive him, because if Dorothy doesn't forgive him, he's not getting back into Oz. He's not going to last the season. So it's going to be a bit of that. Zeb's coming. We're getting Zeb in, and Eureka the kitten, and Jim the cab horse. All that's happening. There's going to be a romance between Dorothy and Zeb, because we've been setting that up for a while. I'm keen to see how that's going to sort of play out.
So I guess they're not cousins this time around.
Oh, no, they're not cousins. No, I've done away with that. And he's not from San Francisco, which is where I... That was one... when I referenced Zeb in the first season, I was sort of run the first couple of scenes, and I referenced Zeb as a neighbouring thing, because I knew I was sort of going to get the character coming in eventually. But I sort of hadn't read Dorothy and the Wizard in Oz for quite a while, and I'd sort of forgotten that, firstly, they were cousins, and I'd forgotten that they were that Zeb isn't a local to Kansas. He's from San Francisco, and when they meet, they're at the San Francisco station, which is why there's an earthquake, and that all makes so much more sense when you think about it in retrospect. But at the time, I'd forgotten about that. I thought it all... I think I was confusing with the Road of Two Oz, where it all happens in Kansas, and it's like... So I'd written that reference, and I saw setting up he's a love interest. I thought, oh, and then I went back and read the book. I thought, oh, hang on, he's their cousins. Oh, yeah, that doesn't quite work. Oh, well, this is how it's going to work in this version then. They're not related, so, which is good because, you know, I've seen, what was it, the Oz Kids, where they had Dorothy and Zeb's children, which feels really weird when you remember their cousins.
Yeah, so.
Yeah.
You're not exactly... on Twilight Ground there, actually, so...
Yeah, it's... Well, that's the thing. It's a lot of these... I mean, there's another version I'm fairly sure. Did Lost in Oz have Zeb, or am I imagining that?
Lost in Oz,
one of the other... Okay. One of the many, many CGI cartoon versions of Oz, which is what everyone's doing these days.
Okay. No, I don't think they did.
There was another one somewhere where I'm pretty sure I heard Zeb... They sort of bring Zeb in as a sort of suggested character. Trying to think which one it was now. Again, I've seen them all. I feel like nearly have seen them all, so it's like various sort of references slip in. I'm like, oh, yeah, that one. But yeah, Zeb sort of seems to default as Dorothy's not love interest as such, but not necessarily, but sort of her another version of, you know, the male version of Dorothy, which, you know, as in the outsider who comes into Oz and has weird adventures. I've decided Zeb at this... Again, this isn't written, so it may change by the time I get there, but Zeb is going to sort of approach Oz in a way that... in a different way to the way Dorothy did. Dorothy eventually, like, she had a bit of a wobble at the start, but she took it in her stride and said, you know, came in and told the entire world to rip their balls off and all that sort of thing. Zeb is going to be a bit more, what the hell is this? Why this... People do not normally fall into crevices and now have... big giant underground cities where people are made of vegetables. This doesn't happen. What is going on? And sort of be more incredulous, because now he's got Dorothy around who can then turn around and say, well, no, it does. Settle down. It's all good. And she can keep the plot grounded while he can have a bit of a breakdown all the way through the series. It could be interesting. But again, haven't been cast, hasn't been written. It could change. We could get someone entirely different in. The whole storyline changes. It's all in flux at the moment. But yeah, it should be interesting.
I'm probably going to be enthralled, but honestly, sometimes I just think, I really wonder how he's going to handle Road to Oz with how that story goes.
I have a plan. There's not a lot to Road to Oz. I've reread it, because, again, doing season three, there was a lot... The problem with Ozma of Oz as a book, there's not a lot of plot to it, especially when you cut out you try and tell the entire first third as a flashback. So suddenly I found I had to find a whole lot more material to pad out the middle two episodes before they get to the Gnome King, because in the book they, you know, they deal with the Iron Giant and that's a chapter, and then suddenly they're there in the Gnome Kingdom and it's all happening with the ornaments. The, So I went to some of the later books to try and find out, okay, what stuff happens in these more travelogue books that I can bring back? And so I reread Road to Oz and realized that's even less plot again. There's half a book before I suddenly end up in the Emerald City to have a birthday party for Ozma, which... So I've got a plan on how I'm going to do that. It's going to sort of feed into Season 6, The Emerald City of Oz, which people who know the books know that's when the Gnome King comes back and the Gnome King invades. Don't know if I should spoil this or not, but why not? It'll be fun. So the I'm seeing Season 6 is sort of like the Avengers Infinity War version of the Chronicles of Oz, where everyone sort of comes into it and everything. It's a big explosion of, you know, lots of references back to the previous season, sort of like the reunion episodes thing. So it's going to be a fairly big, epic adventure. So Road to Oz, I'm sort of seeing, is going to be a more of a sort of a prequel to that. So it's not going to be necessarily a full season. I'm thinking maybe three episodes, but sort of to build into it and sort of, you know, build up to this big event, sort of make it a sort of set up the following season. But again, this is all embryonic sort of ideas and thoughts and so on, and, you know, see what happens when I actually get to writing them. None of these... The fun thing about this is that any time I have these ideas at the beginning, they seem great and amazing initially, but then it sort of turns into, you know, I have these ideas and I think, oh, this is exactly how it's going to work and it's going to happen. And then I come to write and think, oh, it doesn't work like that. Oh, it's not happened the way I imagined it to be. Oh, it's gone in a completely different direction. Okay, well, this is how it's going into now. So, and it's a surprise to me as much as anyone. So I might get to Season 5 and do Road to Oz and realize, hang on, I've got a better idea. It's now going to be a 12-part epic somehow. Don't see how, but it's... Yeah, it could be. You never know.
I guess I'm going to start trying to get this winding down because we've been at this for about an hour.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, Baum also wrote these other stories that tie into the world of Oz. Mm-hmm. Do you plan on bringing those into the...
I do. I've been wanting to do a Christmas special for quite a while, and there's been lots of requests from that, yourself included. But I want to do... the adventure, Life and Adventures of Santa Claus, which I've actually plotted out how I'm going to approach it, and, you know, do that as a one-off special that'll come out on Christmas. So that won't have any of the other Oz characters in it. It'll just be just sort of a standalone thing, but tell that event story, that story, just in the sort of the same style. So it's going to sort of reinvent it a little bit and, you know, rework the plot so it's less episodic and give it more of a through line, all that sort of thing. So make it, but yeah, that's been on the cards for a while, but I've never sort of it's been plotted out. I can see the note cards in front of me, in fact, but I've never actually never got around to writing it, because every time I go to write it, then suddenly, oh, but something else comes up, or like Season 3 took me longer to write than I was expecting, so then suddenly that sort of took over that time, and then, oh, it's too late for this Christmas, I have to write it for the next Christmas, and it keeps slipping in the schedule a bit, but, you know, it'll happen. I want to see it happen. I do want to do the Little Wizard stories. It's going to be a special season on its own. Rob Lloyd, who plays the wizard, and TikTok really wants to do those, because there's at least one where he gets to play both at the same time, which will be fun. What else do I want to do? I want to look into Sky Island and the other one.
Seafarers.
That one, yeah. I haven't read them yet. That's on my list of books to read, but Oz books to read, but I know they tie into some of the later seasons, so I sort of want to get my head around what happens in them, but I've got no idea how I'm going to... This is where it would be really good if I... in my ideal world, I'd love to sit there and just write these adaptations, have someone else make them, because the problem is, and the problem with the structure we have at the moment is I write the episodes, and it takes me a good, you know, 4 to 6 months to properly write out the season and, you know, do second and third drafts and all that sort of thing. And then we get into a studio, we record it, then it takes me another half a year to put it all together. And David Nagel's there and he helps as well, and does all that. And Tony and Diana comes in with amazing music and scores it all, which is great. But it takes a lot of time. Ideally, in my ideal world, I'd love to write the episodes, give it to someone else to produce, and then I write the next one. So the turnaround time gets longer and longer, unfortunately.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to Season 4, and we'll see how many times I listen to the first three seasons again.
Oh, many times. I hope I'll be listening to them again. When I finish the season, I can't listen to it for a while, but then occasionally I go back to it and think, I'm just going to sit down and listen to these, you know, the Chronicles of Oz again. You know, I'll put the headphones on, go sit at the park and just stare up at the sun and just sort of lay there for, you know, 4 hours listening to my own voice talking to me and think this must be how the rest of the world feels like. But, yeah, and, you know, sit there and it's fun to sort of revisit them and think, oh, yeah, we did that. Oh, yeah, that's not, you know, these things that I thought were awful at the time when I recorded them, I said, oh, this actually sounds pretty good right now. So it's fun to revisit it.
Well, everyone, if you haven't heard yet, but you listened to the spoiler part anyway, get to chronicleswaz.com and start listening.
Yeah.
Hopefully we didn't spoil everything for you.
And even we have, just listen to it again, see if what I've said actually made any sense. Yeah. Thank you very much for having me. It's been great. Hope some of it's usable.
And we'll see you in the next one, whenever that is.
Bye.